I just wanted to say that thanks to you, I accidentally made Chris say bitch please to his fiance.
Yeah, that was great. I was doing a little voice dictation. No, when you're out doing IT services for your doctor clients, I hope you are prepared to become an Echo expert, because Amazon has a secret Skunkworks project called 1492. It's a health care tech team working on medical records, virtual doctor visits, and enabling automation using Amazon Echoes. So 1492, the year that Columbus discovered the New World.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of gives you this is the new world of medicine. This is the new frontier for Amazon. That's going to be like discovering the new world for them. Like, they're really going all in with this. This is coming from CNBC. They say that Amazon has set up a secret Skunkworks lab called 1492, dedicated to healthcare tech. Areas of exploration include a platform for electronic medical record data, telemedicine, and health apps for existing devices like the Echo.
I'm rapidly becoming skeptical.
Well, you know, Microsoft's doing it, and Google's tried to do it.
Yeah, sure they are. Here's the thing: I'll rain on their parade pretty quickly. First of all, unless the Amazon Echo is prepared to make a very, very, very compelling offer to Epic, good luck reining in on the electronic medical records. The entire EMR community is kind of settled on one particular software vendor, and they are.
What if they don't do the?
And
what if they don't do the EMR part?
Well, okay.
What if they
all
don't
right,
do
okay,
the EMR
so,
part?
So we're getting to that.
Sit on top of it.
Yeah. So hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in the EMR part. So unless they're prepared to make them write them a really big check, good luck on getting in on that. As far as the telemedicine stuff goes, Philips and GE have dumped hundreds of thousands of dollars into various medical institutions to facilitate telemedicine. So unless they're going to write them a very big check, I don't see GE giving up those profits either. I'm not seeing this.
Setting aside whether or not they can get into the business, if they could, would you be comfortable with them being in that position?
No, but
I'm not comfortable with Epic in that position that they're in either. So it's one devil for another.
Okay, well, here's what I was picturing. So let's roll with this just for a second, because I think you're right. They're not going to get in. I don't think this is a play to get into EMR. I think what this is a play to do more like remote doctor checkup, patient follow-up, where you're using the Echo call-to-call feature. And also, on the back end, Amazon has made huge, huge progress in the medical supplies business. So they're selling more medical supplies than anybody right now. And you combine that with, say, Echoes in customers' rooms and houses, or like care rooms or homes that are buying from Amazon Medical, and you connect them with the doctor's office. Like, there could be a role there for them to play, and they'd still get access to all kinds of juicy data.
You know, I agree with Noah in that I'm not comfortable with this. However, at the same time, I feel like I'm more comfortable with Amazon being those people than these other companies, because they can, at least going back to last week with Google, they can at least take whatever data they get on me and provide that to the doctors to give me a better treatment, maybe.
Versus Google using it for advertising data?
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, is that good? So because Amazon's willing to share information with doctors,
on the flip side, it could also be bad, because they could also share things with insurance companies.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
I have seen a million and one different little, you know, things or whatever been tried to implement into the medical community over a period of the last 10 years. And I'm just telling you, it is never that simple. It's like, so for example, even just the HIPAA regulations alone are going to, you know, I don't know, I'd have to dig into it, but may present a problem if that information is stored on a server that isn't in, you know, the care of the physician or whatever. Like, they have so many.
EC2 is HIPAA compliant.
Is it? Okay. So, I mean, but there are just the mountain of things that they're going to have to overcome. And then not even that, just like the telemedicine thing alone, because it's not just telemedicine is not just you talk to the doctor, you know, over a phone, right? It ties into like the stethoscopes, and it ties into the imaging equipment and the PAC system and all that stuff. And to get interfaces, none of that stuff goes over the internet. It's all proprietary connections. Some of it is over IP, but it's all proprietary IP stuff. So you'd have to have some sort of interface device that's going to have to be manufactured by, you know, in, you know, GE or Philips or whatever, to take that information and then transmit it over the Echo service there is no way I'm seeing this going
anywhere
fast.
It looks like they've hired a few UI designers, some deep learning, machine learning experts, a couple of strategic leads. So to me, this doesn't sound like they're building an EMR or even like something to replace something. To me, this sounds like maybe that's the biggest competitive thing would be a telemedicine competitor, but I still would say this would be more like a it seems like the doctor would be like, well, here's our program. Here's a, I don't know. I'm thinking
less telemedicine and more something where
conference call.
Your doctor could access statistics that Amazon has collected on you, like your sleeping patterns, how often you've been sick.
Yeah, that I can see. Yeah, sure. Okay. So more like
that's the
more
kind
like
of stuff that I think Amazon could do really well with an Echo.
Sure. And I'll take it one step further. There is a company, I can't remember the name of them off the top of my head, but basically they have this little mail-in, they have this little packet, and you take the packet, you rip the packet open, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with what a Holter monitor is, but the Holter monitor, they used to have like this very expensive, like $4,000 little cell phone looking device that had these leads that you stick all over yourself, and they would be put on by the doctor, and then you'd wear it for 24 hours and you come back and they would take the compact flash card out and pull the data off of it and interpret it and process it and all that other stuff. Now this company has come out with this little packet thing. You rip the packet open, it has a little diagram, you stick the little stickers on yourself, and when you're done, you plug the thing into your computer and it uploads all of that stuff to a cloud-based thing, transmits it to the doctor, he reads it, uploads his report, and they mail the results out to you. Like, they've totally cloudified the entire process. I could see Amazon doing something like that.
Now imagine if you had Echoes in millions of homes, would you do?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then Amazon comes out with something, you just put on a patch, and it wirelessly gives data to the Echo and stores that on Amazon servers that doctors can just access from wherever.
In an auxiliary form like that? Yeah, I could definitely say something like that. But I misunderstood the premise of this, but like putting them inside of the doctor's office to facilitate, telemedicine, no way that's happening. No way. Facilitating EMR, that's happening. I could see it
inside of
people's home as like an auxiliary thing to collect. Sure.
Yeah, I could also see specialized, medical echoes in the doctor's offices that allowed them to access that information at a voice command or something, maybe.
Follow up from user error 18, I talked about considering de-Googlifying my life, but it's always something I've talked about. So I feel like it's like dieting, and so like I'm trying to actually make real progress. And so I've decided that I'm going to take like a slow approach, because it's usually when I do like when I did a hard breakaway from LastPass, it just didn't really work out for me.
Can I make a comparison? You're approaching your de-Googlifying like you are your fasting.
That's true. I did. I slowly built up. It took weeks to build up to fasting. Now that we're recording, after we recorded 18, over the weekend, this is a big one for me. I turned off all of my uploads to Google Photos, and I did the big download from Google Photos, and I got all of those photos in one directory, and I rsynced them all up to a droplet. So I have a copy that's all zipped up on a droplet, and I have them all on my local array right now.
Did you disable Google Photos Sync on your phone?
Yeah. So and the reason I did that one is because it doesn't affect my day-to-day work, but it's my favorite Google service. So it's like I'm really committing, because it's out of everything Google does, that's the one, and it's my pictures. And so I actually was looking into, and I would love to know from the audience if anybody knows a good safe alternative to back them up to. I would really prefer to, I don't mind paying a good amount of money if it's a good, secure, private service that has great storage. Now I know that's sort of like an impossibility. I'm trying to avoid rolling my own solution if possible, because it's one of the things I'm really bad at is continuing to check in on the storage after a couple of years, and this is going
to
be a problem.
You could set up regular backups to TarSnap.
Yeah, and just do it right on the file system.
Oh boy, here we go. You have to just let Rikai go, because the guy knows more about backups than anyone would have ever thought. Rikai, take the stage.
What do you think? You think I should just keep it on the file system? Don't bother with the one thing that I really liked about Google Photos, though. It's so searchable. I mean, Noah and I were talking about, like, you can go in there and just type in red box.
Well,
and it will find a picture with red boxes. And that is insanely useful for people that have really bad memories.
I don't think there are any other services that can provide that as well, unless you're just going to upload all your photos directly to Facebook.
No. It really needs to be what I'd like to be is that's. So there used to be a service called, what was it called? Like Picture Life? Or no, it's not that. There was a backup service that was similar to Google Photos where it did face recognition and organization, but it's the only thing they did, and they did private storage, but they got bought out and
so
then they shut down.
Are there not desktop apps that do face recognition using like local CPU
power?
Yeah,
nothing's as good as Google Photos though. Nothing's as good as Google Photos.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking if you do desktop apps, you could back up to Tarsnap, but then also keep those photos local and use the desktop app because it does like rsync.
Yeah. It hadn't even crossed my mind, which now thinking about it is actually great. Noah, what are you doing for photo management and backup? Are you using any cloud services? Have you tried Google? I know you've tried Google Photos with Glass.
Yeah. So I didn't have a choice with Glass. They forced you to use it. Otherwise, I probably would have never even tried it. And it was actually interesting. So when I tapered down my use of Glass, I actually kind of backed away from the whole Google Photos thing because I was like, well, I didn't really want to do it to begin with. But the thing about the dirty little secret about Google Photos is if you have an Android device, they will let you upload unlimited photos to Google and then it copies them off your phone and then deletes the copy that was on your phone. So I like quadrupled the amount of time that I got out of my phone before I had to plug it in and download all of my stuff off my phone because I kept running out of space. So for that reason alone, I went back to using Google Photos. And the thing is, I don't really take pictures of anything that I really care about. Like you, I use it mostly for memory, which means that probably greater than 95% of my pictures that are going into Google Photos are pictures of prices and model numbers in the back of computers and the back of MAC addresses and stuff like that. Anything that's personal is usually, oddly enough, getting uploaded into Telegram, you know, in the various photo streams. I get different photo channels for, you know, my kids or family or whatever else. I'll add one more thing.
It's so central to your life.
What is central? Cloud-based software?
Proprietary cloud-based Telegram.
Right?
Yeah.
good time. And here's the thing. For things that I actually care about, things that I actually truly want to keep and make sure that they don't get deleted and make sure that nobody gets to them and all that stuff, I wouldn't trust it on an Android device.
I really like Rikai's idea a lot because I really trust Tarsnap and I feel like I don't mind if I have naked pictures of my kids up there.
And it is ridiculously cheap.
Yeah, and it works on the command line, which just means I can just have like a terminal window open, just get output and just check in on it, which when it comes to data, I like that kind of output. I'd love being able to see that. I think I'm going to give that a go. But see, the thing was, I was using Google Photos as the photo viewer too. And that I really liked because it was just simple enough to view the photos. It wasn't as fast as I'd like. So a dark table, maybe? I don't know.
You know, you might even be able to get rid of your local photos and just have a Tarsnap loaded up as like a remote SHFS and use the local viewer with the remote photos.
I wouldn't mind hearing if anybody else has any suggestions. I know Amazon has a photo storage service that's pretty competitive in terms of pricing, but
yeah, that's kind of like trading one devil for another.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that's really the route I'm going to go. So I'd like to know what the audience does for their backup solution and if they use anything that's competitive with Google Photos. Let me know at Chris Elias or hashtag AskAir. When you just tweet it out and do hashtag AskAir. DigitalOcean.com. Head over to DigitalOcean and use our promo code Here's the Thing to get a $10 credit. This is a great way to spin up rigs on their really fast infrastructure in less than 55 seconds. And they have data centers all over the world and an interface to use. Dashboard for days. How about I'll just leave it at that. Dashboard for days. Pro or beginner, you're going to love it. DigitalOcean.com. Just create the account and then apply our promo code. Here's the thing. Their pricing's outrageous. They have a whole range from $5 a month and up with systems that have incredible amounts of RAM and brand new CPUs. They have block storage, which you can attach. It's all SSD based and guides and tutorials to get you even further. Wow. Look at all these data centers. Toronto, New York, San Francisco, London, Amsterdam, Germany, India, Singapore. You know, I think that one right there might be near Alan Jude right there. That one right there. I mean, it's Toronto's not exactly his neck of the woods.
You know, Chris,
it's like he's in that area.
I was looking at the dashboard at some point because
the dashboard for days.
Yeah, we need to do it. We need to look at it for something. Mm-hmm. And we've had the JBot droplet.
I know.
For like as long as I've worked here.
For like 4 years, right?
No, I think it's closer to five now.
I should go log in. Oh, I don't have my LastPass on this machine. Yeah, I tell you, when I saw that, I didn't realize how long we'd been DigitalOcean customers.
Yeah.
We've been customers for a long time.
And we've only ever doubled down on them more because we have more of our stuff running on there now.
Oh, yeah. That's just anytime you need infrastructure, really, you should consider it and just go look at it. It's a great option.
Basically, anytime we're doing live content, we're using tons of Dio.
Yeah, it's really for me, it's at the point where anytime I need a computer that doesn't have a graphical terminal, that doesn't have like a GUI desktop.
And doesn't need to be in your house.
Yeah, well, that's almost, yeah, with SSA.
Hey, you know, with X2Go, you can even get a graphical environment.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, you could. And they do have an HTML5 console, which you can use to, but I just, that's my thought process. Like, does this need to be on a desktop or a laptop? No, I'll just spin it up on a Droplet.
And I'll tell you a secret. This isn't official, but you can actually load other operating systems on your DigitalOcean Droplets.
There are ways and methods. Console. Anyways, go to DigitalOcean. You can go to JupiterBroadcasting.com too. Go to DigitalOcean.com and use our promo code, Here's the Thing. And a big thank you to DigitalOcean for sponsoring User Air.
See, Chris, what you should have said is you go to JupiterBroadcasting.com, click User Air in the drop-down, and then you have the code right there.
Right, that's true. That's DigitalOcean. You know what? Do this. DigitalOcean.com, promo code, Here's the Thing. A few weeks ago, the Beard recommended I check out Netrunner as a possible distribution for me to land on. It's kind of well known as a Plasma desktop, and they've got two flavors. One that's sort of like an Arch-based, I think it actually might be Manjaro-based. I'm not sure, but they call it their rolling release. And then they have one that's based on Debian, which is more like an LTS. And they just sort of updated both of them since we've talked about this project.
Before you continue, Chris,
yes, sir.
I need to clarify because people got angry at me before.
Uh-huh.
The rolling release is now its own separate distro.
Yes.
It's called Maui.
Oh, well, you know, it's interesting. If you go to the Netrunner project page, they're still happy to talk about it.
Yep.
So I guess that's maybe where the confusion comes from.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I grabbed Netrunner Daedalus 1706, which is it's based on Debian testing. Because I've recently stated on Linux Unplugged that I'm transitioning away from rolling distros and moving more towards stable releases just because now they're not doing less. I don't have app picks. I don't really need the AUR. Anagross has been giving me some troubles, although I still love them. But this Netrunner release, 1706, is based on Linux kernel 4.9.0. And I decided to go with the Debian one because this is the journey I'm beginning. I intend to spend a lot of time with Solus. And I intend to spend a lot of time with different Ubuntu flavors before I've made my final decision. But I wanted to start somewhere, and I thought if I don't try Netrunner now, I probably never will.
Yeah. Well, plus, also, like, it's nice to try a Debian-based distro.
Yeah. I love Debian, and I haven't used a Debian-based distro in quite a while.
Yeah, there's so many Ubuntu forks, but not nearly as many Debian forks, even though Ubuntu itself is a Debian fork.
Yeah, exactly. So under the hood on 1706, which is, I hate it when the people kind of use stuff that, I mean, I guess Canonical doesn't have a trademark on the year and month, but anyways, on Netrunner 1706, under the hood, you get kernel 4.9, Plasma 5.10, which honestly is what pushed me over the edge here. You get Qt 5.7.1 with that. And on the website, they say it's Firefox 52 ESR, but running it right here in front of me. Oh, they don't lie. I thought it was 54, but they're right. They're right. You know, the thing about ESR, the thing that's nice about going with this 52 ESR release, which I normally wouldn't be all over.
Can I ask, what does ESR stand for?
Oh, it's the extended support release.
Oh.
So it's the LTS of Firefox. Yep.
Surprised Noah's not using it.
But here's what's really... Here's what's really great about it. And otherwise, I'd love to be on 54. But the ESR version, because it's steadier, it's an easier target, has better Plasma desktop integration.
Uh-huh.
So when you do file open, you get...
It uses a Plasma file dialog.
Yeah, which means all my favorites on the left-hand side are there. And it's just way better than that janky old like GTK2-ish.
So what you're saying is it actually makes Firefox a little bit more usable.
It makes it more Plasma desktop integrated.
More integrated.
Which I really appreciate because I spent a lot of time building up my favorites on my left-hand bar. And then all of a sudden when I go and open Firefox, I'm like, I don't have access to any of this stuff. So it's got it's also got Thunderbird 52.1 built in out of the box. Or I guess I should say off the ISO. Steam is pre-installed, which I thought was sort of surprising. And as well as a couple other things like Skype for Linux is pre-installed. And a couple of tweaks to the Plasma desktop that I really like. First of all.
And a few open source games as well.
Yes, yes. Thanks. Yeah, I should point that
GLTron
out.
GLTron. And
GLTron was on there. Frozen Bubble and a K-Breakout and a couple other things are on there as well as Steam. It uses Synaptic for the package GUI package management. And then, of course, it's just apt-get.
That seems like an odd choice to me, though. Because isn't Synaptic GTK-based?
No, I don't. Well, I think there's both. Let me go. I'll double check because I just had it open here. So let me alt-tab over here. It might be, you know, let me see.
It says something about the theming that it's hard to tell.
That's what I was just going to say. So they have two Netrunner themes. I'll get to the other stuff I was going to mention, but maybe this is a good time to mention this. They have two different Netrunner themes that I really like. Plus, then you got your standard like Breeze theme that, of course, and then Breeze Dark that you get, mm-hmm. which is almost 100% of the time when I'm on the Plasma desktop. I'm all about the Breeze Dark. I'm all about yeah. it. However, I'm actually on Netrunner. I'm actually using their theme. They have a blue variant, a Netrunner Blue X, and I guess technically has three themes. It has the base theme, it has Netrunner Blue X, and Netrunner Black X.
Yeah,
look great with GTK.
Yeah, one of the things that initially caught my attention about Netrunner is how good it looked in the screenshots.
Yeah, yeah, it's nice, and I've seen this on before, but it's a Plasma widget that replaces the typical Plasma desktop menu.
Mm-hmm.
So when you hit super key or you click on the Plasma little menu, you get something that at first glance will remind you of GNOME 3's overview. But it's actually better because it has a static page of favorites, and they've pre-added KSysGuard, system settings, and Synaptic Package Manager, and that's it. But it also has logout, reboot, and shutdown buttons right there, big buttons. And what I love about these is they don't double prompt you. Most of the time on the Plasma desktop, if you click shutdown, reboot, or whatever, and then another dialogue comes up and really says, are you double sure? Yes. You know, I know how to use it. Mm-hmm. Yes. So it doesn't do that. So it has type to search. It also has categorization, so you could go through a full screen menu if you want, which is touch friendly. I'm using it with touch right now, or mouse friendly. And then they also list on another tab all of the Plasma desktop widgets in the same overview pane. So this overview pane comes up over my desktop. It darkens the entire desktop. So it doesn't disrupt my workflow. It's like a UI that sits on top of the desktop, and the white bold font is easy to read. It's easy to see all of the Plasma desktop widgets right here. It's super fast to search, so I can do, you know, super key terminal enter and it just launches immediately.
It's like if you're at school and teacher writes on the chalkboard, but then you pull down the whiteboard and turn on the
projector. Yeah, exactly.
And then you can go right back to the old stuff.
Yeah. This also has Yuake, the drop-down terminal, pre-installed and turned on.
Oh, Yuake, yeah.
Yeah, Yuake. And I would not describe this as a super lightweight desktop, but it's also pretty much all the stuff I would have installed anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So, really nice. Yeah, go ahead, Noah.
No, here's a million-dollar question. What is it that you see up front that you're like, 6 months down the road, 8 months down the road, this might be what eventually takes me back off of this distro?
Probably the lack of PPAs. I think that's, if I'm going to be on a Debian-based distro, then why not go on one that's Ubuntu, and then I get a much broader compatibility? So that's what, Netrunner to me is, if I was just a Debian guy and all my stuff was in Debian, this would be like a slam dunk, but I still want wide software availability.
It's interesting, too, because that's what I always struggle with. Anytime I find these distributions, I'll get really excited for a little bit, and I'll say, oh, man, I have found it. I have found the needle in the haystack, the distro. And then I start thinking about it, and I'm like, no, there's way too many smart people out there. If there was one distro that was just so amazing, it would probably, everyone would have migrated to that. So, like, if I'm going to step outside the comfort zone of, you know, the Ubuntu, which is the Linux operating system, I'm going to step outside that. There has to be a really compelling reason to do that, right?
Well, you know, there's a good chunk of folk who just don't like Ubuntu. They just don't like it. Maybe they don't like Shuttleworth personally. Maybe they don't like Brown. You know, they just really don't like Ubuntu or what they're about or Canonical. And, you know, this... Once you look at that market of Linux users, this I think is super competitive. I think this is a really nice distro. I installed it on the Dell XPS 13, like sixth generation or whatever it is, and everything works. I it's kind of a shame that Plasma in 2017 doesn't auto-detect high DPI. Elementary OS beat them to the punch on that a long time ago, so you still got to go in there and turn on the high DPI stuff. But my touchscreen works. My Wi-Fi works. It's actually been running on battery for quite a while. The battery life is really good because it's been on battery for 3 hours, and it says it still has 4 hours and 35 minutes left till the battery's dead.
Wow.
Yeah. And I've been installing software. I ran that WebGL demo, that full-screen WebGL demo, for way longer than I should have.
Yeah, and you're running everything off Wi-Fi right now, too.
Yeah. And so, I mean, Plasma 510 is solid as hell. This thing is rock solid. Debian, I mean, it's Debian testing, but Debian testing is pretty good.
I kind of have sort of the opposite question of Noah.
Hmm.
What do you like about this distro over KDE Neon?
Well, that I don't know if I don't know if I can answer that. I don't know if I can answer that yet because, you know, it's been a little bit since I've tried Neon. I'll tell you what jumps out at me immediately about Neon is that Neon is above and beyond a great Plasma workstation, meta distro or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's got a little bit of Fedora's rep for being a bit of a test grounds, which Fedora is trying to move away from.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the end of the day, I got to believe Neon's primary motivation and intention is to showcase the best and latest new technologies of the Plasma desktop,
mm-hmm.
where Netrunner's primary motivation is to ship a really LTS-y Plasma desktop. And so I feel like this, if I was in the Debian ecosystem, if I was a Debian distro user, this takes Debian and makes it really great on regular desktop hardware.
So basically you're saying that would be your desktop if it had PPAs.
I don't know yet, but it's a strong contender. It's stronger out of the gate than I expected.
Yeah.
Part of it is Plasma 510 has gotten so damn good, and once you turn up high DPI, I got to be honest with you, I mean, it feels really good still, even in 2017, to be able to just load any random Linux distro on this Dell XPS 13, and I just woke it out of sleep. I just put it to sleep and woke it up, just woke up fine. Woke up super fast, actually. I should say, woke up super fast. Like, it's checking all the boxes. The only thing is, like, you know, I really feel like the Ubuntu 17.10 flavors all around are really interesting this year. So I can't commit yet. I need a date. There are so many fish out there, but the first distro I try, the first fish is
looking pretty attractive.
Yeah, I'm really surprised. So maybe the competition's going to be harder than I expected.
Yeah, well, you still got Slackware to try.
Yeah, but I don't think I'm just going to try that as a serious distro to try.
You know, I kind of want you, just as an aside, not necessarily to search for your final distro, because I know you're looking to go more LTS-y. I kind of do want you to try Maui just to see how much polish they can bring to a rolling distro.
Yeah, and you know, and compare it to Andagros, which I think is currently the best Arch-based distro
mm-hmm.
out there. And so to compare it to Andagros would be really interesting. Yeah, and now that I've been impressed with their Debian-based one,
if they can bring like 90% of that polish to a rolling
distro. So the feedback was saying it's a totally different project now? Is that what they were saying? Because, you know, I'm looking at their website, and they have like blog posts and news announcements about the rolling release on the Netrunner site.
If you go to their download page, though, I think it forwards you to the Maui website.
Oh, okay. All right. I see. Either way, pretty solid release. So, yeah, Netrunner rolling, and then Netrolling. So on July 18th, the Netrunner team is happy to announce the release of Netrunner rolling.
What the hell?
That's some pretty direct language there. That's... After 18 months after its release, Netrunner is now available again to the two biggest non-commercial community-driven distributions, Debian and Arch/Manjaro. Yeah, this one was tempting, too, because this one has kernel 4.11 and Firefox 54, which obviously is very appealing to me. But you can go with their Debian version, and you still get Plasma 5.10.
That's from their website.
Oh, I see. So there's also... So Maui is Ubuntu-based, and Netrunner Rolling is Arch-based.
But that release is also rolling.
Maui also marks the transition from Kubuntu to KDE Neon. Oh, buddy.
That might be your thing right there.
So this is, they take KDE Neon,
okay, so
which is based on an LTS base.
So they have Netrunner Debian, Netrunner Rolling, and MAUI. And MAUI is probably pretty similar to Netrunner Debian, except on based on Ubuntu.
I think this is a bit of a...
KDE Neon?
Okay. This is all starting to click now. I read some stuff in their forums about project members splitting ways. And that there being some drama, and that's why there was such a huge delay in Netrunner releases.
Well,
so there, I bet there was a split in, should it be based on Arch or should it be based on Ubuntu? And so Netrunner Rolling is going to continue with the Netrunner branding, and it will be based on Arch. And MAUI is some of the people that left the Netrunner project, and this is my supposition based on the back and forth. This is all kind of clicking now. I don't normally follow distro drama. In fact, one of the things I liked a lot about Arch was zero distro drama. I couldn't tell you a single drama thing in Arch, really.
At the bottom, it says, regarding Netrunner, Netrunner will not disappear but continue in another form we are actively working on. If Netrunner Rolling will be continued, it will be decided in upcoming months.
I got to say, like, this is another thing I really like about Ubuntu Mate, is the way Wimpy really runs his community, right? And it's a drama-free community.
At the same time, the drama couldn't have been too bad because they were still nice enough to each other that they announced it on the Netrunner site.
Amicably, the way it seems that publicly on their news outlets, all seems pretty amicable. So to me, it wasn't a big deal. This stuff drives me crazy.
But still, that might make MAUI worth looking into.
No kidding.
If it's the
Ubuntu base,
some of the guys that did Netrunner and
getting the Plasma desktop stuff from.
Well, there you
Neon
go. There's another one for your list, Chris.
No kidding. All right. Well, thanks, Rika. I guess you're like my distro dealer, dude. You're getting me hooked back on the sauce.
It's funny because I'm the one here that uses Linux the least, but I'm giving you guys all the good ideas
and troubleshoot them when they go wrong.
I was just really impressed. So when you double click on the Netrunner readme that they include on the desktop, which I normally don't do, but I was like, this time I'm compelled to do it. I opened it up, and in there they have, if flash isn't working, this is your command, and if you're having some trackpad issues, which I just realized I was during the show, this is the command to install the package you need to fix it. And I like, I love these guys. So I just pasted it right in the terminal and installed it. So good on them. They really, that readme is worth reading once you first install it.
It's probably, we can't include this in the distro because it might screw up things for other people.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Yeah. Although I got to say, when I just wanted to double check that I'd done everything to enable high DPI properly, because again, Plasma doesn't automatically do it. Guess where I wound up to make sure I'd done everything right.
Where?
ArchWiki.
You got it. Yeah, you got it. I added them on the. I'm like, yeah, damn it. Again, it comes to the Arch Wiki. It's just so damn good. It's at the top of the Google results when you search for it.
So, Noah, while you were on vacation, I believe I linked you to a certain article about a product that you used to love that
I was
you
sitting did. Right that, next to him.
That you disappeared did. And appears to have returned.
Boy, was he excited.
How does it make you feel?
Let me ask you this. Let me ask Chris this. Because that's right. Chris was sitting across from me. How long did it take me from the time that I comprehended what it was I was reading on my phone till I had my wallet in my hand and was attempting to purchase glass right on my phone sitting in your RV and crappy
Boy,
internet?
If you ask me, no. I mean, my recollection was like one fluid motion. I don't really remember separate moments. It was like a reflexive, like, as you were reading your screen, your hand just went for the wallet, dude.
I have tried eBay. I tried submitting a request to sign up as an enterprise partner for Google. I have tried contacting Google. I've tried the old Glass contacts. I have tried people that I knew that worked for Google that I cannot find a way to, like, tomorrow order the thing and have it shipped here. Or I can't find somebody, even somebody who has access to it and wants to sell it for, like, three times of what it's actually worth. I can't even find that.
You love it that much.
To be fair, I think that post was announcing the return of it, not the availability.
They will get back to me when availability is.
Ah, okay. Geez, so that's like a don't ask us, we'll call you.
Yeah, but
oh man, but that's like now they've teased you.
Or wait until you see the release and ask
here's
again.
Here's the thing: we all know because we're all adults here. I'll just admit this: there is the it's available for everyone, and then there's the it's available for those people who know what they know and are able to get it. There's always a way to get it before there's a way to get it, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there probably is. Yeah. Noah, it really registered for me. There's the one thing you said during our Montana trip that I've kept going back to is Noah said that he really feels like there was a period of his life, like pre-Glass, post-Glass. Like it was that big of a tool for him.
Well, going back to the Google Photos thing, apparently that was a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so I bet you eventually you'll find your way to it, but I wonder if it's going to be what you really want anymore. Like if they're not like pushing like people developing cards for it and stuff like that, if they expect people to brew their own apps that are going to use it, it might have a lot less functionality than you expect. And did you see too that they added a record light too, which is fine, but
yeah, I agree. I mean, a piece of electrical tape would fix that if I didn't really like it. But the here's the thing, and I said this on Ask Noah too. If I take a phone and I take my phone, I turn it around, and there are plenty of apps that will record with the screen off, and I place the phone into my front shirt pocket, that camera is seeing way more than, as much as glass would see, but it is way less inconspicuous. Anytime you used glass, even before they did the record light, the screen was always on previewing what you were recording, which meant my eye was glowing purple. Now, if you don't notice somebody has a smartphone strapped to their head and their eye is glowing purple, if that isn't obvious to you, then I don't know what you're – I don't get it. But so I don't really see the huge concern of privacy violation. But here's the thing. I never really used any of the external apps anyway. I use the camera function like 99% of the time, and I use the weather function and the time function.
Notifications.
So as long as those three things are there, I'm happy.
That makes sense, yeah. I have the same feeling about automation to a degree. People always really, really roll their eyes when I talk about like getting an Echo and smart plugs and stuff. But my whole family is using like the automation stuff that we've done. And I know you've done this at your homes too. Like my kids now know how to turn on all the different lights and heaters and stuff. And Hadia's all in on it too. She actually really likes it. Like it's not just like she's tolerating it. Like she really likes it. And I couldn't imagine like now if we're going to get a new set of lights. The next thought process is, well, do we have a smart plug? Yeah, that'll be fine. Like, that's how we do everything now. I'll save this for a future show because I just wanted to say I really do understand, like, that whole, like, I remember life before we had this convenience or this capability, and now there's life after it.
Life enhanced.
Yeah, and so I could totally understand how glass could be a tool like that, especially if you're memory challenged.
Yeah. Now just imagine some sort of circumstances going to where that tool is no longer available, or you know is not widely available, and then you have to go back. It's one of those things. It's like once your eyes have been opened to this, now how do you go back?
Yeah. Imagine if now that all your stuff is Alexa integrated. Imagine if your Alexa stopped working.
Cancel.
Well, so to shift topics, just to shift, I mean, this is a hard transition, but the Wi-Fi network in Lady Jupe's has got to be replaced.
It is
so weak. All props to Cradle Point. I really like what they're trying to do there. But damn if that thing doesn't crash a few times a night and cause me all kinds of problems. And then you combine that with the fact that I'm on this crappy Wi-Fi that's throttled. I can't rely on anything cloud-based, which Noah's just going to love to hear that. I've been migrating actually off of Echo because of that reason.
Can we go back to the Google Glass for a second?
Yeah.
I have a hypothetical for you guys. So it's not there yet because it's still a giant heads-up display kind of thing.
It's early AR.
Well, that's what I'm going towards is – so if Microsoft with their – what the hell is their thing called? HoloLens?
Yeah.
If they could make that smaller, so it's a LeVar Burton-style visor or something, or some glasses that have, like, AR enhancements, would you guys buy that from Microsoft?
From Microsoft?
Yes.
How functional is it?
Well, it seems pretty functional already.
But, I mean, like, is it, like, as capable of Google Glass but more? Does it have a camera?
I would say that it would be...
It has to have a camera. It's doing AR.
It would be providing a contextual overlay of the world for you.
Well, I'll tell you, like, I would not be an early adopter.
It's got cameras on it, and it's scanning the world.
So it's a competitive product.
And it's providing contextual overlays of things that you're actually seeing or give you more context.
If I was totally aversion to this idea and concept and Google Glass wasn't a thing and you said, who would you trust more? I might say Microsoft.
Yeah.
But then now that Google Glass is already a thing... That just, I don't know, Noah. Where are you at? I gotta ponder that. Where are you at on this?
I have a very strong hatred of Microsoft, and I would have a hard time. I'll lay my cards on the table. Here's the thing. Every single time I have ever trusted Microsoft to do anything, no matter how remedial, simple, straightforward, they always find a way to screw it up. every single time. And I just a complete aside, just a total tangent in left field, and I can't even help myself. Did y'all know that RDP supports multiple monitors? Unless, of course, you don't have Windows 7 Ultimate Enterprise. If you only have the regular professional, you know, the one that ships on every freaking computer that you buy from the OEM, if you have that version, you can't look at more than one monitor. And the fact that I have... I gotta get out. I get up on myself. All worked up. No, I would
not
trust anything from Microsoft.
To flip, Noah.
I would not want for all I know, here's how I envision Microsoft to go. And when I say this, you're both gonna go, yeah, I could see that happening. Microsoft is going to come out with this little glass thing, whatever, the competitor. And at the start, it'll look pretty compelling. It'll be all right. It'll be okay, fine, that's great. And then all of a sudden, somewhere down the road, they'll change the game, and it will be, well, now you have to have a subscription to Azure and have some sort of .NET framework running on your desktop that crashes every 3 minutes to use to upload the photos or something like that. The amount of times that Microsoft pulls the rug out from under you is like in their nature. It's married to their DNA. They're incapable of not screwing up somehow.
I would agree with you if it were entirely software-based, but lately...
Yeah.
Microsoft's hardware division has been really damn good.
I was like going to be 100% with what Noah just said, and then you're like, yeah, okay, that's...
Because think about it. The Surface laptops have actually been pretty damn compelling. Setting aside the whole Linux thing.
And this would be more of a hardware product from one of these
On top
games.
Of that, you've got the Xbox.
Not just... I mean, so not even just like the Surface books. Even the regular Surfaces are amazing. And by the way, run Linux.
The only recent failed Microsoft product I can think of is the phones, and they were their own retarded division.
And they weren't; those were not Microsoft created products either. Nokia. That was licensed to OEMs and stuff.
Yeah. Okay,
but everything
kind of
Microsoft themselves have made hardware wise.
I'm kind of on board with you. Yeah.
Oh man, Jesus!
But
this
here's the thing. I still revert to if I'm going to have something that is going to capture data, cloud process data, run data, give data back to me, analyze data, stuff like that. I'm still The better experience is going to be with Google, hands down.
Here's what my answer would be. Having listened to Noah, I think I pretty much align with where he's at. I think what I would do is I'd probably wait till the fourth or fifth iteration of the product, and I would watch with an extremely skeptical, but I would continue to research it and ask the audience. And then after the fourth or fifth iteration, if it was a really compelling product that nobody else was competing with, I would probably consider it.
See, the problem I have with the glass versus HoloLens comparison is that I don't feel like Google is going down that route.
No.
I feel like Google is going down the route of, here, let's mount a cell phone on your face and you can run apps.
Yep.
Well, and it's more of a, now it's even more like, especially when you're in this warehouse with inventory or machinery.
Right.
It's just like, this is a really good route for them to go down because Microsoft has had a more diffused approach with HoloLens. ARKit is a platform for iPhone but requires people to completely wholesale build their own application on top of it, where Google Glass could be a much simpler, much more straightforward, pop right into their safety goggles or new safety goggles or helmets. That's the other thing is they've announced a pod that is modular that can go into working helmets and things like that. So they're really thinking about the enterprise. And when they say enterprise, they mean large companies that have warehouses in manufacturing.
I will finish off with this. I am actually, for the first time in as long as I can remember, excited for a Microsoft product.
Oh, really? Going back to HoloLens?
Yeah. Like, that's the first compelling product to me that they've released in a long time that doesn't have anything that's vaguely equivalent.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we'll see where it goes. We'll see where it goes. And Noah, you got to let us know the minute you get the Google Glass. Because
I make you this promise. I promise you I will be one of the first people, if not the first person, knocking at Google's door. When I was talking to a friend of mine that works for Google, and I said, if you can talk somebody into letting me purchase even at a higher than average price, I will fly to Google today. I will come down there today and pick it up. That's how bad I want it. I'll come meet with whoever, talk to whatever, do whatever, do a review, whatever it takes. Just find me a way to get me glass.
And when you come and visit, Noah, I will let you try my HoloLens as well.
LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. That's your super secret destination where you can support the show and get a 7-day free trial to a platform that's built to teach you all about GNU/Linux. It's a full-featured training library with everything you need to learn new skills or advance the current ones you have. So we're talking like the real basic stuff with Linux and then up the entire stack and chain. It's really, it gets from like, this is how you set up a basic firewall. These are the basic commands. It goes from that kind of stuff, which is very valuable for a lot of us, to the stuff where maybe you want to take your career to another level. Like maybe you really want to learn and figure out OpenStack or figure out how to program in Python, or maybe you're even kind of curious about Azure. They have courseware on all of it, and they have instructor mentoring standing by ready to help you, real human beings that know this stuff, hands-on scenario-based labs, self-paced video courses for every Linux cloud topic you could think of, study tools that you can download and read and listen to offline. Hallelujah for that. And iOS and Android apps for when you're on the go. And if you're just going to get that cert, they've got courseware that's really, it's like a pipeline. Really going to help you get there. And then if you want to go maybe down a path, they have learning paths, a series of courses and content planned by their instructors for specific career tracks. It's pretty nice. You just get started by going to linuxacademy.com/unplugged, get a free 7-day trial, and support the show, Linux Academy.
I tell you what, Chris, something you guys don't talk about as much. If you're a young guy and you're just trying to get into the tech sector, and you don't have any experience, or you didn't go to college for some reason because it's too expensive or whatever, if you go take a Linux Academy course, that is going to put you ahead of so many people on your resume.
Yeah, Linux Academy is really gotten to a very respected position, too. And they're working with the Linux Foundation. They've really gotten a great name for themselves, and it looks good on a resume.
Yeah.
LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. One of my favorite desktop Linux applications, and I feel lame for saying it, is Unmaintained, but I am a gedit lover.
No, you don't. You don't sound lame at all. I use gedit all the time. But here's the thing, though, too.
I thought you switched to Sublime Text.
What? Well, I do use Sublime Text. But here's the thing.
Oh, I still use both.
Here's the thing, though. When I need to,
absolutely.
So I'll tell you what I use gedit for all the freaking time. Let's say I'm copying text off of a website, and then I need to put it somewhere else, and I want it to strip all the formatting off. Gedit is just like the in-between. And the thing about Sublime Text is there's just enough of work overhead to get a new file, open, paste it in, close it out, don't save it, that I just won't do it. Whereas gedit is just kind of my volatile memory kind of dump thing or whatever. I couldn't live without gedit. But here's the thing. My answer to the whole gedit thing is going to be... there is such a thing as completed software. Do some software hack thingy to make it work with, you know, newer GNOME, whatever. But it works. Does everything I need to do. I can open text. I can save text. I can close text.
So it turns out to be a more complicated job than you would have thought. So gedit needs a few things fixed. It's got a couple of problems with the way and there's some maintenance work that needs to be done. But the issue is, under the hood, you essentially have to be a four-language master. Because so gedit itself, actually like core gedit, is fairly straightforward. But the issue comes into, I think it's mostly written in C. But then there's some Objective-C stuffed in there.
Let me guess, is there also Vala?
There is Vala, sir. There is Vala for the plugins. There's Python 4. And of course, there's Objective-C for the Mac OS support. So I'm losing count already.
Wait,
at that point.
Gedit's on Mac OS?
I guess. I didn't know. And then, of course, there's like very special things you have to do to get it to even build. There's like something you have to develop to even get it to build. So
Plus,
the guy's kind of put his hands up.
The part you're not mentioning is that you also need to know all of the GTK stuff.
Yeah.
Which is basically its own language.
Yeah, so I guess you're kind of right, Noah. I mean, it's definitely feature complete for me. I don't really need to do anything else than what it does. I just don't want it to break with as the platform moves forward. So that's kind of where they're at right now, is they're getting closer and closer to GTK 4, ladies and gentlemen, and of course your friend and mine, Wayland. And so they need changes and fixes.
Well, on the other hand, that might be a good point to break and just redo the code base from the ground up. Try to hit the same feature complete level, but on a one language code base, maybe.
So I just opened gedit just to kind of see what exactly is there to feed. Like I'm looking at every little thing I can click on here.
No, you can't do this. You make a straw man. You can't do this. You can't, because it's not about, like, it's your Thunderbird argument, but just it's repackaged. It's not about adding features. It's about the fact that the platform, like, so it's tying into, like, things built into GTK and X right now that are being deprecated.
No. Sorry. I was responding to Rakai's argument. He was saying that why not just write from the ground up? And I'm looking at it. How hard could this really be to rewrite? Oh. There are nine menu options that I can see, plus the open button.
Well, I guess it's the plugin system.
Yeah, probably the plugin system.
I guess that's
apparently the OS X support.
There's a plugin system?
Yes.
Tools? How do I do plugins?
Yep.
I'm not seeing plugins.
People turn Gedit into like a darn like IDE practically.
I'm not seeing highlight mode. I'm not seeing plugins. How do you do plugins?
Yeah, there's like Markdown plugins. They're all in the AUR, dude.
Well, there's not a button for. Maybe you have to install them separately. Anyway, here's the thing. Let's do Gedit, and we don't need plugins. Let's just have like regular. All I need is just a basic text editor that launches instantaneously and has a big save and an open button. That's what I need.
Can I tell you about my friend Kate? It's a great text editor on the Plasma desktop. Check out Kate.
Oh, here we go. So at the bottom, you can click on plain text.
What you're saying is that they have a horrible user interface where it's hard to find things?
Well, I've never bothered. I never needed to do anything other than plain text. I never looked. But so can you do marketing here? You can. It works. Hold on.
Hang on.
This.
What is going on right now?
Hang on, Chris. Did you?
We can't put any of this in the show.
No, we can't.
Oh my gosh,
Chris, listen to this, Chris.
Noah's got an O over there.
Noah, shut up
for
a minute.
You're googling. Okay,
listen, Chris.
I'm not googling.
Did you know that there is apparently an integrated Python console in Gedit?
Well, there you go.
It's one of their features.
That's probably why Python is one of the things you got to know.
Okay, that is legitimately cool, and I didn't know you could do that. Down at the bottom, you can change to a different language, and
it's
then it like, does all the syntax.
Yeah.
You know what Gedit is?
It's a classic GNOME 3 application in such that it will fool you with its simplicity. Because at first pass or two, it really is quite simple. But then you dig into it and you're like, oh, wait a minute. A built-in Python console, a Markdown plugin, I can turn on line numbers. Wait a minute. What about this? Syntax highlighting? What can do this?
Hey, Chris, I'm going to do an experiment here. Do you want to hear Noah's head explode in real time?
Sure. Let's see what happens.
I'm going to send him a link to the plugins that are shipped with Gedit.
Oh man.
I will send you this link as well.
Yeah, well we can put that in the show notes too. Do you know this show has show notes for a lot of things we talk about? If you go to jupiterbroadcasting.com, you'll find not only do we do time codes of the show, but you'll also find links to a lot of the stuff we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have Telegram.
Oh my gosh. There's a
cool?
file browser. There's a file browser inside of Gedit. Are you serious?
Remember when you didn't think there was much to rewrite?
Yeah, so I guess
This like super Gedit, but here's the thing: for what I really need is just a basic text editor that we call Gedit.
You know, that's
so
what they're
going to
do.
The same way.
That would be the GNOME thing to do. That would be the GNOME thing to do.
Rewrite it and remove functionality.
Basic AF text editor, and then they'll add features over time.
Oh yeah, they'd probably rebrand it to GNOME Text. So Chris,
yes sir.
Chase and I last week.
You guys stirred up.
We started a revolution.
Did you step on a hornet's nest? I don't know.
It's
a revolution, a revolt. I don't know how you want to describe it.
It's kind of like people walk up to me and they just give me a hug. And, you know, hugs are cool.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, somebody over their shoulder punches me in the face.
Yeah. Yeah. So Noah can be our third party supposedly. We'll see. Unbiased arbiter, because no, there is a dramatic dispute that is ripping apart the Jupiter Broadcasting community. It came up on last week's User Air.
Okay,
it's a
own opinion, so I'm happy to I'm happy to officiate.
And it turns out when Noah's not on the show, he listens to the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, so here's what happened. Noah is a topic was brought up. It's ripping apart the community, and I got to say it's starting to gain more and more momentum. And I want to know your thoughts. So, the Beard and Chase last week recommended that JB launch a Discord server and perhaps even consider switching our on-screen IRC over from IRC on the video screen to Discord.
To be clear, I did not say that we wanted to use Discord exclusively for one.
Correct, right.
A lot of people think that's going to be the only thing. Not necessarily.
So having a week in between shows to look at it, I got to say I'm very impressed with what I see with Discord, especially when it comes to moderation, in that we can have an audit log. So if somebody claims that the moderators abused them, we actually would have a log of it now, which would be new and nice. There's also like the ability to let people like more granular permissions, so we could perhaps have some perks for our patrons in there. We could have specific show areas. It also could do a lot of the functionality that Mumble does.
It also has direct patron integration, so we wouldn't even have to like add patrons. It would just add them automatically for us.
Damn, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Like one of the things, just as an idea, is like this as an experiment, we are recording this week's episode right now over Discord with Noah. And the idea was, is like, you know, we don't do this show on the air, but if we had a certain User Air patron level,
we could have a channel that only allowed staff and patrons could join us on shows if we felt that we wanted
and
to
then
include them.
And you could have other rooms, of course, like, say, like the Linux Unplugged room, which would be available to anyone.
Yeah.
Anyway, and it gives people who are not experts tools to check their internet connection. Like, it gives you, like, cellular signal bars, which that sounds like a dumb thing, but having a three-bar system that tells you if your connection to the server is good or not is... We can just ask people, do you have three green bars?
Those bars, they also change color if your connection gets worse. So you can just see at a glance if it's becoming crappy.
It's like having the dummy light on your Ethernet port. It makes all the difference.
It's a small touch that makes a huge difference.
So there's a lot of little things about it. It has a lot of like more modern chat features. It has pretty good mobile apps. So people could join us from the road. There's a lot of pros to it.
And just to clarify, it's not necessarily a dumb interface either. You can go in and dig in and get advanced information as well.
But, you know, a big blowback, especially from people using IRC. They really don't want something that replaces IRC.
I would say like 85% of the blowback is IRC.
Yeah.
Like people on Telegram.
Yeah, there's a couple people.
There's a couple people that are against it very heavily, but most people they're like, yeah, I want this. This seems even easier than Telegram.
So it is one of those things that it obviously has some momentum behind it, because two weeks ago we also experimented with Discord, and within 5 minutes we had 1, 2, 3, 4 people from our community join us and hang out with us.
And we didn't even advertise the URL. We just
we took a picture of the screen.
Semi-accidentally included a picture.
Yeah, we semi-accidentally put a picture of our Discord chat client in Telegram.
With the invite link up.
And several people figured it out pretty quick. Yeah. And we're in and we were chatting. And so it's one of those where you could tell they're, okay, this is something that has a lot of momentum. And then one more thing. Okay. Outside of that, it's outside of JB, outside the open source community.
It is huge. It is massive.
So like new audience, things like that.
Yeah. And you can also publicly display your Discord server on like Discord server lists. So it could just be we could get random people coming in that don't know what JB is and they can learn about it.
All right, Noah. So we've laid out the pros because that's what we've been digging into since the conversation came up. I initially started in the conversation pretty neutral and skeptical last week, and now I'm starting to see some benefits. And Beard seems to have dug up some ways we could possibly integrate the existing IRC chat room and a general Discord chat room. So like we wouldn't be if people wanted to stay in IRC, they wouldn't be getting left behind.
So there's a bot way to do it, which would relay between IRC and Discord and actually a bunch of other services like, I believe, Mattermost and Telegram.
Really?
Yeah. And then there's also a different way to do it, which would be something that people can set up on their own called Discord IRCD, which would let you use your IRC client to access Discord. It acts as a middleman, as an IRC server.
They also have a Linux desktop client. Yes, it's Electron, but they have a desktop Linux client.
And that one is not open source, but it is the official one. But there's also a command line client that is open source.
There's a command line client. And they're using for like the voice stuff on the back. They're using WebRTC, Opus, that stuff.
All the industry standards.
What do you think so far, Noah?
I think that if it was up to me, I would vote nay for a couple of reasons. First of all, I am a big fan of the lowest common denominator. I'm always a fan of take Discord. The lowest barrier to entry, and go with that, and that's going
the
to
Walmart. Well, yes,
yeah. Walmart.
Don't you think
exactly.
Discord
Walmart,
is pretty low barrier though? I mean, you
it's
and
not,
I set
though.
It up
it's not,
in like 30.
No, it's not. It maybe is easy to use, but you're going to have the JB community is largely comprised of free and open source advocates and Linux advocates. And one thing that's going to be very important to them is a free and open source platform. And that's why companies like Red Hat, despite being 2017, are still using IRC for their internal company communication rather than something even like Slack. But you carry that on, though, too. Look at then you look at the Mumble community. Right. I would say even there's a couple people that, you know, that aren't going to care. But there are a lot of people that show up inside of the Mumble room that are not just there for Linux Unplugged. It's an entire community that's evolved outside of the show itself. And those people will never get on Discord. People like Wizard, people like Zeraki again would probably be a good example. I'm trying to think of who else, you know, Mitfried, those guys are, you know, they're very stuck on using open source stuff.
My counterpoint to that would be that Yeah, there's that group of people that are on Mumble. But if we have our main chat room with an attached voice service, don't you think it would bring a lot more people into a voice chat if they're already there and they can just click a button and be in the voice chat?
I think when you're trying to get a approach an audience that nobody in the Linux community has anything against Mumble. I mean, they pretty much they'll jump over mountains to use even ridiculously complicated pieces of software and spend the time to sit there and configure it. It's interesting. They won't take even something as simple as a website that you can visit if they know that the back end is running a bunch of proprietary stuff. It's a really interesting phenomena.
I'll say from my perspective, the things that I would say, if you're comparing the chat, they're not. Mumble is much more of like an IRC style chat, where
I wouldn't even say that. I'd say IRC is a lot better.
Okay, it's more like Yeah. So it's a very plain chat. It's not a primary feature of Mumble.
No, where, not at all. In fact, they don't. It's really not even. It's just kind of there as an auxiliary thing. Really, the idea of Mumble is you close the program and you don't think about it, and you have a hotkey that you press when you want to talk inside of that room. I very rarely ever have the actual Mumble window open.
I think what I like about Mumble is I've left it open and running for ages, and it's been really solid. What I don't like about it is the pain in the ass I go through every time I have to get a new guest onto Linux Unplugged. The rigmarole, it's gotten to the point where producer Michael has just written up a website that I can link people to, and then I still have to ping him and say, hey man, can you be on standby for this person, because they're signing up Mumble for the first time and they're going to have issues, because it's just rough edges, but, you know, creating a certificate, configuring the audio interface,
so we'll break that up into two parts. So first of all, the certificate thing, that is all something that we have intentionally created, and there is a reason for it, but that is not a necessary function of Mumble. You don't have to generate a certificate. You don't have to add permissions and all. That's all optional. You can just turn all that off if you wanted to.
Right. Except in broadcast, I do need that stuff. It is not optional for me. But
I disagree. I think that I would do it. You could do it with just ACLs is how I would set it up. But that's not how it was set up at the time. But anyway, be that as it may. The second issue is, you're right, there is a configuration barrier. But my argument to you is that you are trading the hassle of configuration for letting somebody else. For the cloud, that's what you're doing. You are offloading the configuration to the cloud. And the thing with the configuration is, I can take the time and walk somebody through steps. And as long as that is, I have control over that infrastructure, I can keep that server up and running. Discord goes offline, you're done. That's it. The server shuts down, or they have a DNS thing, like, or Amazon AWS goes out. Now you're done. There is nothing. There is no, I can manually walk that person through. And I will take the, it's under my control, but there's a little bit more hassle every single time. In fact, I prefer it, which is one of the reasons I don't use things like the Roku, because it brokering that connection, going out, giving me a single little code, and then it links to all my accounts. Again, I'm trading the manual configuration for the cloud, and I never make that choice, ever.
All right, you're jumping all around here. There's so many things I could respond to. I want to keep us on track. So one thing, the configuration to the cloud, not really. So it's not that the server hosting to the cloud. Yeah, you're definitely punting on the server hosting. But like the configuration I'm talking about is like setting up the audio interface, setting up push to talk versus voice activation, the noise suppression versus the noise boosting.
That's all being done in the web browser, though.
That stuff I think is that. Well, I think there's a fundamental difference here. So you and I are talking it on two different levels. That stuff, I think, is that way in Mumble because it's an open source project that has a certain amount of funding and time spent on it, whereas Discord is like some massive product that a company is spending money and time on to have UI developers figure out the best way to design a select your sound input. Like if you just look at the two applications side by side, one has clearly been put together by enthusiasts and one has clearly been designed by people that are thinking about usability. So I don't think that's because of the cloud.
I don't know if I agree with that. When I went into Discord, it just popped up the regular Mozilla drop-down menu and said, which audio interface do you want to use? Which would be the same thing in OpenTalk.
Right. So if you put, I don't know about, I'm not using the web version. I'm using the Electron app. And if you go in and look at the settings.
Oh, it's the same in both.
Gotcha.
Look in the settings. It's pretty nice. It's a really well-designed, easy to understand. Now, keep in mind, I'm talking about like, I'm trying to get a guest on Linux Unplugged. And I want them to go set the right audio interface and that kind of stuff. There's other things to consider, but I don't actually think one necessarily replaces the other either. So
yeah, not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot. So I think part of it is,
and then, you know, and then the last thing, the overall thing is, I'm always a big fan of eat your own dog food. So if we take the approach that we want more people to use open source and Linux based operating systems, and then we come across a software stack that say, oh, well, this isn't quite as good. The answer, and we've had this discussion on User a couple of times, where you say, no, don't bury your head in the sand. Let's work and make it better. So in this example, you're at the fork in the road. You have these two choices. Should we not be bringing attention to Mumble and saying, here are the things that we like better about Discord that we would like to get implemented in Mumble and work to make that suit the needs rather than dump it and jump on the opposing ship at the first sight? There's something that just doesn't feel genuine about it to me.
I think you got to reframe the conversation because, you know, I really, 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 I really don't want this to be a Mumble versus Discord conversation because
I agree.
I hate it when we compare two tools that do different jobs against each other. It's not worth it. Mumble is a great application, and I actually, in my personal opinion, think it sounds better than Discord does. So there's that. But I just to reframe this conversation really quickly. So your question about, man, if there's an open source tool, because I think I'm going to rephrase it to make sure I understood your question. If there's an open source tool out there that basically does the job, it just is a little bit of hassle, but it does the job, versus a tool that is totally proprietary, not open, and cloud hosted, why not use the light of our broadcast to shine on the open source project to get more users, to potentially get more development, to make it better over time just by more people using it, right? That's essentially the argument.
I guess a slight twist was your argument was that there's a lot of money being poured into Discord. My response to that is instead of jumping on the bandwagon and giving more reason to pour more money into this product because more people are using it, shouldn't we be trying to get more people and funding over to the competitor project?
So like on air, promote funding the Mumble project?
Something like that, yeah.
Can I make a counterpoint?
Or maybe a certain percentage of something like that.
I'll quickly respond just to let Beard get to his point. One of the things I've been noticing a lot, and I was going to actually read the email on air, but I didn't bring my phone where I had it loaded. People want us to fall on the sword constantly. Why doesn't Jupiter Broadcasting lead the way? Why don't you guys are talking about open source? Why don't you eat the dog food? And you know, I sure have done that a lot. I mean, I have done that more than probably anybody else in this media space. And I got to tell you, at some point, when is it my turn? When is it my turn just to get to use this stuff and not have to fucking fight with it all the time, to not have to set up servers, to not have to worry about certs, to not have to worry about crazy audio things? When is it my turn to just get to hit a button and have something that's great, that really works, that integrates with Patreon, that supports voice chat and text chat and image stuff? Like, why do we always have to be the ones? Why is it always us? Because meantime, other people, they're not following these same rules, and they get to get to the end goal a lot easier and faster than we do. So it's like I'm holding back my competitiveness to some degree.
My answer to that would be you do. You get to do that with things like FFmpeg, and you get to do that with OBS, and you get to do that with Mumble back in the day before, you know, Discord was available. I mean, I think that JB has greatly benefited from the work of others and provided, you know, and, you know, not only just that, you know, if you look into the actual community aspect of it too, back when you're testing the Slack thing, and he said, you know, maybe you should use Mattermost. And one of the counterpoints you brought up was you said, well, it's really nice to just have something that's up and running and somebody else takes care of it, so I don't have to actually set it up. And he went through and set up as far as I know, it's still actually running, set up an entire Mattermost instance so that it was hosted and dealt with and nobody had to manage it. And so that would be my answer is I think that does happen.
So I mostly agree. I was just playing devil's advocate because there was an email that came into the show recently where I was griping about net neutrality and my internet connection. And the guy says to me, this is the common thing. He says, of course, why don't you just stop paying for internet for a few months? So he's saying,
go offline.
Go offline for like 3 or 4 months. Then take that money and go to an RV park and buy them all new Wi-Fi, set it up for them, and get them going. And there's this constant idea, perception out there, that for some reason you should just use the less functional piece of software because it's open source. Why don't you just go offline for 3 months to donate money to some RV park? Like, I don't understand this constant. And when I don't do it, when it's like it's perceived as me being not genuine. I don't understand that. But so that's just where that was coming from, because that's been the theme that's been coming in over and over again. And at some point it's like I don't understand. I like right now. I don't really see I could have gone on for the next few years with IRC for chat, Mumble for voice, and you know what matter most for rich text chat, I guess, is how it's kind of working in the community right now. But it does seem handy to put it all in one place.
Well, also, none of those have the integration features. I did want to bring up one counterpoint to Noah. Discord did go out of their way to make a Linux desktop app. So isn't it also our responsibility as Linux users to support people that support Linux?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, I think that's fair. I guess here's what I don't see happening. I rarely see it happen in any space, really, where somebody starts on a very highly functional piece of proprietary software and then leaves that software for an open source alternative. I'm not saying it never happens. I'm just saying I don't see it happen very often. I do see all the time people leaving an open source piece of software when a new shiny proprietary piece comes out. And if that trend continues, it scares me, because the long term, the longevity of anyone bothering to invest their time to develop free and open source software, when some company can come along, dump a couple $100,000 or millions of dollars into something, and all of a sudden, boom, overnight, these other projects go away, or these other projects become less valuable, I guess, because there is a proprietary alternative. I'm not exactly sure that that's I don't know that that's a mentality, if that's a trend, I want to support.
So let me ask you, final, like just as a conclusion from your remote judgment as the third-party arbiter that's now come later on, what do you think of the compromise solution of a bridge/bot that essentially, if you want to stay IRC, you do that, but you still get to participate, like the chat rooms are essentially combined into one mega chat?
Yeah, I mean that's certainly going to sure that certainly will facilitate the people aren't able to join thing, absolutely.
I still know that Noah is secretly hoping that you're going to try Xmonad.
Oh, well, here's the thing. I don't really care. I mean, I don't personally really care, but I will say this. Having used Xmonad, like it's one of those things. Once you try it, and once it hooks you, and maybe it will never hook you, but once it hooks you, you can never go back from it. And that's why I was telling Rikai earlier today over Telegram. I just bought on Wimpy's recommendation the Skull Canyon, and I installed it, and I have Xmonad running on that. And
cool,
it's like,
dude.
And your sense of relief is my sense of, okay, great. The desktop's out of my way now. Now I can just go back and get to work. Yeah. And I was working today, and I had like, I don't know, probably 7 or 8 different windows up, the virtual windows for the virtual machine, Vert Manager, and a couple terminal windows, and my email. And to be able to just kind of like, oh, I need to get over to this one, and then now that one's full screen, go to that one, now this one, and just, it's hard to explain, but once
I can totally see how that's appealing. Yeah, I could see that. No, everything is, it's all up, you can see it all, you have a great overview of everything at once, but you can zone right in on an area.
You know,
exactly. I get it.
You know what I just heard in there, though?
What? Have you ever used Prezi?
No.
That's kind of a weird question. But Prezi it's an alternative to like Impress or PowerPoint or whatever. But basically the idea of Prezi you know what I mean? You set out all the ideas and then you zoom into one idea and back out and zoom into one idea and back out, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I look at Xmonad too, is like I can see everything at once, and then I can work on various things, and then I can concentrate on a cluster of windows or a single window.
You know what I just heard from all of that is that Noah is adopting my full screen workflow.
A little bit. So we've gotten that recommendation a lot for the OBS machine is drop GNOME 3 and put Xmonad on there. Do you want to talk about, I want to address that really quick. So Noah, you got to help me here break this down, because here's where I think my prejudice is in things like Awesome and i3 and Xmonad, because they all are really kind of appealing to me in their own way. And I totally grok, especially like if I primarily had like my notes and a lot of terminals, man, that just makes a ton of sense for me. But I legitimately have been using a Windows desktop environment since the 80s.
Yeah.
And so I, when I learned how to use computers, I learned how to use overlapping windows in a way that allows me to visually maintain threads. And I can I move between applications by stacking the windows in such a way that I can always see a corner of a window, but I'm not distracted by the contents of the window. So I can immediately always activate any window I need, either with obviously a keyboard command or a click. And it just works so much better for me.
You were describing the exact reason that I have tried tiling window managers and cannot use them, because having so many tiled windows just gives me information overload.
Mm.
And it super distracts me.
Yeah, I guess that's – so I suppose if you don't – like anytime I have a window open, all of my windows are full screen. I rarely, if ever,
don't
full screen a window. The only exception to that is if I'm talking in Telegram and I'm working in a web browser, then I'll position the window so that they're both there. But I can do that actually much, much faster
so,
in Xmonad.
Hmm.
So what's the advantage of tiling then if you're usually full
screen? Well, you don't spend time positioning, right? And when you're not,
yeah, but in most modern distros, you can drag one window to the right and take up half and drag the other one.
That's true, but the window will take up the same amount of space every single time, and usually it's like half the screen or whatever, right? Whereas with Xmonad, I can tell it like Telegram never needs more than a certain amount of pixels wide because, you know, it's a messenger, and I always want it on the right side. And my web browser, I always want it narrower than wider because most web pages, you know, are actually best, you know, yeah, they're long. And terminals, I wanted the exact opposite. I wanted as wide as possible so that it's not wrapping text around.
Yeah, that sounds just like how I like to do it.
I actually believe that there is a way in KDE to do like custom snap sizing per app.
Oh, so sure, that sure. So I was just going to – so you are thinking the same lines I am. So because I agree with everything Noah just said. And except for I find that I like to change it up a lot. So if you saw me on a Wednesday – my windows are arranged in a totally different way than they would be on a Tuesday or a day like today. It's just, you know, it's like depending on the work. But one of the things I like is I generally on those days am always using the same applications. So Terminal, 3 or 4 Dolphin windows, AvidMux, Oaken Audio Editor. Like those are the applications I'm launching on Wednesday dozens of times. And so what you can do is advance Windows controls in Plasma Desktop, and you can say, always open this application in this area on this monitor. That is super size. Yeah, that is sort of my middle ground there, is because I only really need this for like 3 or 4 applications, and then I like to have it for Slack, and I like to have it, but I don't really need it. And all the other stuff, I'm constantly repositioning every day.
Well, I also think that you can set up custom desktop layouts.
So
you can have
in workspaces
the same apps in different workspaces and different layouts.
Yeah, just not workspaces. I don't use that feature, but there is that Plasma Desktop feature where essentially you have an entirely different desktop. Like you have multiple virtual desktops, you can have an entirely different workspace. I think it's just called workspaces.
Yeah, but it's the same apps just arranged differently.
Yeah, yeah.
At the click of a button.
Patreon.com/JupiterSignal. Just a quick mention here on the User Air program. We're putting out a patron-exclusive podcast from time to time. We came up with a little idea that I think is going to be fun. Your very own Beard from this podcast will be joining me soon.
Hi.
Yeah, so if you're a patron, you'll get access to that. You get an RSS feed, which you can subscribe to automatically. And then there's a teaser episode out now, so you can get the feed set up in your podcast player of choice. And then when we publish that one, whenever you and I get a chance, maybe tomorrow morning,
I thought we were going to do it today.
Well, we were going to do it this morning, but now we ended up doing 2 other shows today. So,
well, we could do it after.
Yeah, we could. You never know. So it'll be
nice and punchy.
That's our way of saying it's coming very soon. Patreon.com/JupiterSignal to not only support this show, but also to support all of the shows. We really appreciate it. Patreon.com/JupiterSignal. We got a new segment in the show. I don't even know if we have segments on this show, but we're calling it the Ask Air segment. Hashtag Ask Air on Twitter. So we got a couple. We just mentioned it last week and a couple came in. Let's start with the first one. Alex asked, what's our favorite food? Going around the table, I'm going to actually say mine's changed recently. I used to say anything that was in like the general American Thai food menu. And now it's Indian food, butter chicken, Indian food, and naan is, I'm all about it. What about you, Noah?
Oh, gee, let me think. Hold on, let me think about this. Salads, that's my favorite food.
Yes.
I really like a good lettuce. No, Indian food.
No. Indian actually, food, it's your fault that I'm so into Indian food.
A very close second to Indian food would be Chinese food.
Oh, yeah, 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 I love. What about you, Beard? Is it pizza?
No.
No? Lasagna?
Which probably, no, no. It's actually a very small subset of Polish food.
Oh, really?
I really enjoy pierogies and plotskis, which are like potato pancakes. And I don't get to have them a lot, so it makes me sad.
Boy, you're making me hungry. Let's stop talking about this. All right, so a couple other comments came into the show. At Official Cammy says, it never hurts to try something new in regards to Discord. If it works, cool. If not, you could always revert. And at Sam Urilla tweeted us, at RekaLP and at Nunes are right. We should be using Discord. There are lots of benefits to using it and keep everything in one place. Hashtag ask air. Wow.
You should also, because some people misunderstood, Chris, search ask air in the Telegram.
Are you serious?
Yeah, there's people that use
all right,
the hashtag
so
there.
I guess, have we mentioned the Telegram group on this show? If you go to jupiterbroadcasting.com/telegram, it'll redirect you. Did you know we have that URL, no? jupiterbroadcasting.com/telegram?
I was not. That's
Boom.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, you could. So ask air in this. So people, well, actually, I guess it works to do in the Telegram group, too. So Eric wrote, yes, let's go to Discord. I have too many chat apps. Ha, ha, ha. Well, wait, what? That seems like one more chat apps. That doesn't seem good.
Well, maybe he's talking about consolidating them all into one place.
Because Aru Fox, yeah, that's probably it. Hashtag ask air. Discord is a yes for me. And Emery says, hashtag ask air, yes to Discord. Wow.
Yeah.
None of this was pre-planned.
Nope.
I just, wow.
So you know what this
that
proves,
is,
right?
That was everybody that wrote in said yes.
Anybody that's not an IRC wants Discord?
Yeah.
No, I was going to say anyone that has a strong, if you like something and you want somebody to move towards you, you're very vocal.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in the status
and
quo.
If you don't really care.
Yeah. Oh, no, don't worry. They're plenty loud too.
So anyways, send us your questions to the show. You can tell us about Discord if you want, but I think we probably talked it out. We'll just talk about it more later. But I would love to get general questions into the show. Hashtag ask air.
I also got a PM on Reddit asking me questions.
Oh, and by the way, I need to say error.
Specifically for me.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, good. Oh, so this was a private back channel question?
This first one is kind of something you have to answer, I guess.
Uh-oh.
Question number one is, what do I have to do to get Rekai more on Jupiter Broadcasting shows?
Oh, well, tune in to Linux Unplugged. So Beard, when available, maybe sitting in on third seat for a while on Linux Unplugged. And, of course, we got the Signal show.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be future projects down the road, I would imagine. Right, Beardly?
Is there anything that the audience can do to make that more likely?
I
don't know.
Mostly the only thing that really holds us back is funding, so Patreon, really.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, like if we had more time, like if we had Patreon funding to hire an editor today, we would hire them and have them work with you for like a month or two to learn how to do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would be the perfect time to also be spinning up shows as that person became more capable.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would say it's probably funding.
And I guess also the...
Or we cancel all the other shows.
Also the whole... Twitch thing for me to give me a secondary funding source.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which something I wanted to clarify because some people asked me and got confused last week. You do not have to have an Amazon account to sub to me on Twitch. You can just sub to me directly using money as well. The whole Amazon Prime thing is just an extra thing that you can do to not have to spend money if you already have Prime. Yep.
Yeah. People seem to take well to you, Rekai. So is this so back channel message that came into you here? Was that the question, or is there another one?
There's another one. It's more based towards me, but I think you guys can answer for some of your machines as well. He asks what systems I run. He says that he knows I have a few systems and servers, all Linux, some Windows, some Linux. He saw on my Twitch page that I had an i7 920 and a GTX 970, but he didn't know if that was the specs
so
of the guy I was hosting.
Hashtag ask air, what are your rigs? We got to keep this because, like, I can't name every system we use.
I'd say your main rig.
I don't have, like, a main rig. I have, three main rigs.
Yeah.
Does this count as a rig too? One of my main rigs? Does
no.
It, okay.
This is, right. this is a studio show rig.
Yeah. It's got all my SLR. Okay.
So for me, I actually have, my main rig is actually a very old system. It's got an i7-920. And
it's a good chip though.
A GTX 970, which is relatively recent, but not powerful enough for the stuff I'm trying to do. And it has almost no hard drives because they've all died on me. So I'm running on a 250-gig SSD and nothing else currently. My new rig is going to be a GTX 1080 Ti that I will be buying in a couple weeks. It's water-cooled.
Mm-hmm.
A i7-5820K that will is also water-cooled. And a 500-gig NVMe SSD.
Are you going to do the clocks of Overing with the water-cooled stuff there, or is it just so that
no,
way you're never pushing it?
It's I mostly went water-cooled specifically to have a silent system for streaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be nice. Okay, so that's your main rigs?
And both of those will eventually run Windows, much to Noah's chagrin. But I also have a NUC that I kindly stole from you. That right. will be exclusively run Linux. It actually already does. And then I have the editing Mac.
I don't remember the... I don't have the CPU models memorized in the rigs we built. But they're, two generations ago i7s?
I think your specs are actually the same as my new rig.
Okay.
Or my old rig.
Yeah, yeah. So we have one of those as my main desktop. And then in the studio, my laptop is a newer MacBook. Which predominantly runs OS X, and then my rig at home is an XPS 13.
You primarily use that MacBook for editing, right?
Yeah, I basically don't use it unless I'm editing.
Yeah.
And so that's like the three machines I bounce between, and the XPS 13 is now running Netrunner. It was running Arch with the Plasma desktop, but it is now running Netrunner. And then I also have at home, but I don't use it as much, is a MacBook 2013 that runs Arch. It actually has the GNOME desktop. I don't really change that one very much. In fact, I don't think I've even updated it for like a month. So that's like the machines I most... My workhorse is the custom-built desktop.
What did you install Netrunner on?
The XPS 13.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's sort
Man,
of like the...
that laptop looks so nice.
I know. Where did it go? Oh, it's... Yeah. I know what I love about it is this is why it's really the one I use at home the most, is because Hidea and I like to stuff it between the cushions and the couch.
Mm-hmm.
And then when either one of us wants something with a keyboard, we just pull it out of the couch.
It doesn't feel like the size and weight of a laptop. It feels like a large hardcover book.
Yeah, or a tablet.
Like a 10-inch tablet.
Yeah, that's what it feels like to me. What about you, Noah? What are your main rigs?
Yeah, so I mean, I have, you know, probably 15 or 20 computers in my house that are used for various different things. But if I was condensed down to the ones that I spend the most time on, I have my main workstation at home. It's a i7 something or other with 32 gigs of RAM and 6 screens connected to it. And then I have my main workstation at work, which actually just today got swapped out. We're a Dell partner, and so I always have some form of a Dell workstation, usually a Precision desktop workstation. And I replaced it today, about 2 or 3 hours before we actually sat down to record this episode, with an Intel Nook Skull Canyon, which I got on recommendation from Wimpy.
Timely.
And yeah.
How do you like it so far?
Well,
so it sounds new, but how do you like it?
It's shockingly powerful for its size. You know, it's, I don't know if you've seen the Skull Canyons, but it's,
oh yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit smaller than the Nvidia Shield, and it's a ridiculously powerful machine. And Wimpy showed me how I can connect a desktop graphics card to the thing.
Yep.
And get full on, you know, graphics performance.
It's got that Thunderbolt goodness on there. That's why you know what's cool about that, dude, is if you buy an external graphics card for your NUC, mm-hmm. then every laptop you get afterwards has Thunderbolt 3. That you buy one GPU and it works across the machines.
And
if they
here's
have
the other
connectors.
Thing I've done that I'm pretty proud of myself for. I have a USB-C dock that's on my desk, and then there is a connector cable that runs down to the Skull Canyon. So if I want to, I can plug it into my laptop and run my laptop off the thing in my office, or I can just unplug it from my laptop, plug it into this little connector cable, and then use the Skull Canyon. So and then, of course, I've got my ThinkPad that I have with me all the time. And between those three machines, I'd say I do probably 90% of my work.
Once again, I'm noticing a trend here, though, that many, many months before.
You recommended the Skull Canyon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And an external GPU to Noah.
Yeah.
So,
who was the first person I said, hey, by the way, you may have been right about this, and I ended up buying this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's behind the scenes. Yeah, you didn't just bring that up, did you?
He was right about Netrunner, too. So this thing's got two M.2 slots in it. Did you fill both of them?
I am embarrassed to say that I had somebody else put it together for me, so I don't know what's in it, actually. It's whatever they put in it.
Oh, wow. Look at you, big timer.
Well, yeah,
you just big timed a nuck. You just big timed a nuck, dude.
It's actually kind of embarrassing, if I'm being honest. But it's got a 1 terabyte something or other in it. It's obviously an SSD. I don't know if they're both in there or not. But.
I love it.
You know, there's commands you can run and tell you what's on it.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I don't heavily use storage. In fact, my last ThinkPad had a 128 gig SSD in it. And the only reason I got a 512 in my new one rather than a 128 was because the only one they offered in M.2 was 512. I don't really use a lot of local storage. I keep most of my stuff on a little flash drive with me.
It could be an NVMe drive, too. So, I mean, it could be pretty
good.
Oh,
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I guess it also has support for an NFC header if you had maybe NFC keys or something. It actually seems like something you might actually do.
You know, I tell you what.
It's got a VESA mount, too.
The NVMe large size hard drives in M.2 format are probably one of the most overpriced components in a PC these days.
Super bad.
You want to take a guess at how much a Samsung Evo 960 512 gigs is? No, 1 terabyte is.
Let's see, 1 terabyte? Is it more or less than $800?
Less.
Okay, good. Whew.
Not much.
Oh, really? Is it six something?
Yep.
Wow.
It's like $630.
I don't want to start a war or anything, but...
Oh, are we about to get into a storage battle?
I feel kind of strongly about the Pro over the Evo. Is that something that you would dispute with me, or...?
Oh, maybe I'm actually thinking of the Pro.
Oh,
yeah, I think I'm thinking of the Pro.
Yeah, the 850 Pro is that's the creme de la creme of hardware.
Yes, for most people though, I would suggest the Evo over the Pro, because there's not many people that need the extra performance the Pro provides.
Yes, but you say that because of cost savings, not because you think it's a better drive.
Correct.
Okay, good.
But I still think it's an extremely good drive.
It is. Yes, it is a good drive. The Evo and the SanDisk are on par. The thing that's neat about the 850 Pro is it has some of the same performance testing.
960.
That the Intel Enterprise drives, like the $2,000 Enterprise SSDs, and it has some of the same performance things. In fact, we have actually put 860s in... servers and put them in production use with people banging on them and never had a problem.
I do believe it's faster than those Intel drives.
It
now.
Is. They are. But the thing that Intel always boasts is it has so many read cycles and write cycles, and the 860 actually can compete with that, even though it's not certified as an enterprise drive and even though it's like a third of the cost.
The reason I specifically want to get a 960 is because I am prepping this system to be able to record 4K 60fps footage.
Whoa! Yeah, buddy. Yeah, buddy.
I have the 960 on my laptop, and I love it.
That is a crap load of bits per frame.
Yeah. Let's turn the user air probes inward for a moment, gentlemen. I have a deep question for you. What's the best life lesson you've learned? And maybe it was too late, even.
Well, for me, I'm going to go ahead and go on the record and say the life lesson I learned too late is that... I really hate other people trying to exert control over my life and it just, it's one thing that, if I would have identified that earlier on and been able to take a more proactive approach, I think it probably would have benefited me, but now I just get to a point where anytime I get the idea that somebody is trying to tell me what to do or force me into a situation or attend something I don't want to attend or be involved with somebody I don't want to be involved with, I fly off the handle.
That's good. That's honest. No, that's good. That's
well,
deep.
At the same time, did you learn that too late, or I feel like you still have the time to turn that around.
Yeah,
that's true. That's
here's
true.
The problem is it has evolved into a knee jerk thing where it bypasses the conscious part of my memory bypasses the conscious part of my brain and goes straight to. It fists through walls kind of thing.
Well, yeah, but what I mean is because you learned that lesson, you don't let that happen in future stuff, right?
I would like to not let it happen in the future, yeah. I've not been terribly successful.
Exactly. So it's not too late. It's too late for that situation, but overall it's not too late.
Ah, fair enough. Well, that's an encouraging piece of advice.
And honestly, that's my fundamental issue with that question is I don't think it's ever too late to learn anything.
Oh, that's deep, Peter. Go for it. Go for it, brother.
Because for
what about, like, you know, spending too much on a credit card or driving crazy or
well, the only time it's too late if you're driving crazy is if you kill yourself or someone else.
Yeah, okay.
And as for a credit card, like, I don't see that as being a problem, really. Like, yeah, you put yourself in debt, but you can get yourself out of that debt, and you've learned that lesson.
Okay. I suppose you're right. It's never too late until you're dead.
Maybe that's the
That's some deep S.
That's the lesson a lot of people never learn, and that's too late for most people.
They get, oh, man, this you're going meta. Like, they get set in the fact that they're an old dog,
yeah.
And they just decide they can't learn new tricks.
Yeah, they don't learn from the mistakes they make, and they just keep making those mistakes instead.
Beard philosopher.